Okay, well, good afternoon once again. This is Richard Klemm coming to you live today from St. Paul, Minnesota on June 24th for Ethics 2018 Part 3. We're doing a live conference call today, and we're also recording the program for a future podcast. We left off the last session either live or the earlier recordings with Rule 1.14. So in our remaining time, we'll be starting here with Rule 1.15 and plotting our way through the end. And as you see, we have a lot of material here. So this last hour will actually probably run over a little bit. I'm not sure if I can, on the recording, if I can give you more than 3 credits. But if so, I will try to do that. We'll plod through in the next hour and 15 minutes or so, starting with Rule 1.15 all the way to the end. And on these, we'll have a little bit faster pace, obviously, because if you look at the materials, we actually have a lot more material to get through. This actually does avail itself to going a little bit faster. And starting with Rule 1.15, we're talking about safeguarding a client's property. And I could spend actually a lot of time talking about Rule 1.15 because here is an area where you have a lot of specific rules. Because mostly what Rule 1.15 is talking about is the various rules governing your trust account. The rule starts out with a general statement just saying that, yes, you have to use reasonable care in protecting any tangible property that comes into your hands during the course of a representation. So if you get the bearer bonds or the gold bars during the course of your representation, well, you have to take due care to safeguard those. Lock them up in your vault. You can't just put the multi-million-dollar property in your desk drawer of your unlocked office, obviously. In many cases, that might require you putting that client property in your safe deposit box. In general, the bulk of Rule 1.15 talks about the rules governing your trust account. And there are very specific rules governing your trust account. Depending on what state you're in, those rules might be found in different places. In Minnesota, there is an appendix to the rules of professional conduct. I forget right away whether it's called Appendix A or Appendix 1. But those rules governing your trust account and the record-keeping requirements governing your trust account are incorporated by reference into the rules. And that appendix to the rules has as much force as the actual rules. And we're really not going to be covering it in detail today. Similarly, the state of Iowa has a separate document that governs the trust account rules and the record keeping requirements and so forth governing your trust account. That's incorporated by reference within the rules. It's not called an appendix. It's called a separate rule in Iowa. So there's a separate chapter of the Iowa Supreme Court rules governing your trust account. Wisconsin treats it a little bit differently, and those very specific rules are written right into Rule 1.15 of the Wisconsin Rules of Professional Conduct. So the Minnesota-Iowa version of Rule 1.15 is very short. The Wisconsin version of Rule 1.15 goes on and on because it has all these very specific details. And we're not going to go into those specific details very much today. I'll put in another commercial here. If you need a few more credits, I do have a CLE program covering the Iowa trust account rules, which are pretty much the same as the rules in other states. So if you need a couple more credits and you want more details on exactly what your duties are with respect to your trust account, you can look for that program. Perhaps in the future I'll have one specific to Minnesota and or Wisconsin. So you can look for those if you need the details. You are strongly encouraged on an annual basis to read through that appendix to the Minnesota rules, or those separate Iowa court rules, or the full text of the Wisconsin rule, because there are some very specific requirements on what has to be done with your trust account. I'll hit some of the high points during the course of today's program, but you can go into a lot more depth, and you should do that. But in general, in any state, the rule governing trust accounts is that any time money comes into your hands that in the course of a representation that belongs to either the client or belongs to a third party, then there's an absolute rule with really no exceptions that money has to immediately go into your trust account. And that can either be your pooled trust account, that most attorneys think of when they have a trust account. That could be your pooled trust account that you have at the bank. That's where it goes most often. That's the only trust account I've ever had to deal with. Or it can go into a separate trust account for the benefit of one particular client. And you're always permitted to do that. You can open up a separate trust account just for one client. You're always permitted to do that, but you're required to do that any time the amounts of money involved become such that you can account for that particular client's interest. So because that money belongs to the client. So any interest earned on that money really belongs to the client. But all of our states have a rule saying that can go in a pooled trust account, and the interest earned on that money goes to an office of your state Supreme Court, where they use it for some purpose, such as in Minnesota, it goes to the Client Security Board to help people who have been ripped off by their attorneys. Or in other states, it might go to a pro bono project or so forth. Because in most of the practice of law that I have, the interest earned on that account is such a negligible amount that it's really not worth the accounting. Because how much interest did my trust account earn last month? Well, I probably earned about 12 cents or something. So it's really not worth the bother of saying, 7 cents belongs to this client, 3 cents belongs to that client. Instead, that entire 12 cents goes to the state of Minnesota, where it's used to go to the Client Security Board. But if I had $1 million in my trust account that was going to be held in the trust account for a sufficient period of time, then the accounting, it's not an accounting nightmare trying to figure out where this 12 cents goes. It's, the $742 of interest money goes to my client. So in those situations where I have a large amount of money held for a sufficiently long period of time, then I do have a duty to open a separate trust account to deal with those situations. But if it's $100 in my trust account for the next 10 years, the interest doesn't really amount to enough to have to worry about that. Or similarly, if it's $1 million that is in my trust account for just a few days, then that can just go in the pooled trust account, and we don't worry about that small amount of interest that's accrued just over a few days. But in general, when I say the money has to go in the trust account, it's the pooled trust account. But there might be situations where a separate trust account is necessary. At this time, I'm going to give the first code number for the third hour of the program, and that third code number is E321. E321 is the first code word for the third hour of the program. E321 is the first code word for this part of the program. So again, the first rule is that money belonging to the client always has to go in the trust account, no exceptions. The corollary to that rule is money belonging to you can never be in your trust account. But to that part of the rule, there are two exceptions. And the two exceptions are you are allowed to have money belonging to you in the trust account First of all, if it's a small amount of money necessary to cover reasonable bank service charges as they arise. We had kind of a semi-official ruling from the Iowa Supreme, or from somebody in an Iowa state office who told an attorney that $100 is the appropriate amount to use for that. And I think that's kind of an appropriate amount, that you can have a $100 in your trust account to cover bank service charges as they arise, or check printing charges, or, you know, wire fees or whatever, because those fees are the responsibility of you, and you can keep that money in there to account for that. What you're not allowed to do, though, is you're not allowed to keep a cushion of money in there to avoid possible overdrafts. Because if you keep $1,000 in there, well, that's not a reasonable amount to cover the bank service charges as they arise. So you are not allowed to just keep a cushion in there. Now, is that rule fair to you and me who practice in small firms, who rarely have very much money in our trust account? Well, no, it's really not fair, because the big firm downtown, they don't have to worry quite so much about overdrafts, because you know, today they just deposited $1 million from the, you know, the Acme widget case in there. And, you know, tomorrow they deposited $5 million because they had some big real estate closing going on. And if they accidentally made a slight miscalculation and accidentally wrote a check to a client for $500, and there was really only $400 in that client's portion of the account. They don't have to worry about that quite so much, because they have a cushion in there by virtue of the fact that they just deposited these other funds in there. But for those of us who are small practitioners, if I accidentally wrote a check to my client for $500 and there was really only $400 in the trust account, that would generate an overdraft. And I'm not allowed to keep a cushion in there. So that's really not fair to me, the small attorney, because I have to worry about that more than the big firm downtown. But unfortunately, life is not always fair. And that's just something that we have to deal with. And we all, even that big firm downtown, because they'll eventually get in trouble for their sloppy bookkeeping. You and I have to be especially careful of that, because you never, 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 never want to have an overdraft in your trust account, because a notice will go to the, in Minnesota, to the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility, and they will, even if you were not at fault, even if it was just a totally unavoidable occurrence, you will have some splaining to do in that situation. So you don't want that to happen. So you want to be really careful with your trust account. But unfortunately, you cannot be really careful just by maintaining a cushion in there. Your trust account also comes into play when it comes to advance fees, because basically, any time a client pays you money to do work and you get the money before you've actually done the work, before you've actually earned the money, that money has to go in the trust account and it cannot be disbursed to you until earned. And as I mentioned, so those are the main points of the trust account rules, and it has to be an interest and lawyers trust account. And I do have a link here to both the, I guess it's Chapter 45 of the Iowa Court Rules that covers the very specific rules, and I have a link to that in the materials. Similarly, I have a link to the Minnesota document, that appendix with materials. So you want to look those over on an annual basis, because when you sign your bar or your attorney registration statement at the end of the year, or in other states when you sign your bar renewal, somewhere in there it says, I hereby attest to the fact that all of my trust account records are fully in compliance with the applicable court rule. So you do want to read those on an annual basis. A couple things to watch out for. If you have a multi-state practice, if you're admitted in more than one state, that might require you to have a trust account in more than one state. Because in general, those auxiliary documents say that your trust account in most cases have to be in the state where you practice. So the Minnesota trust account rules say your trust account has to be with a Minnesota bank. So if you have both Minnesota and Wisconsin clients, when we get to Rule 8 point something, we'll see their choice of law provisions. And if your Wisconsin clients are just a small fraction of your practice, well, then maybe you can get away with just having a Minnesota trust account. But if you have a substantial practice in more than one state, you might be required to have a trust account in more than one state. Wisconsin especially they're kind of stickler for details on a few points that maybe Minnesota is not quite so much so. Because, for example, my trust account would not, there have been times when my Minnesota trust account would be in utter violation of the Wisconsin trust account rules, because Wisconsin is very specific, saying that everything associated with your trust account has to have the word trust account on it with no abbreviation whatsoever. Well, my checkbook is okay because my checks are printed with the words trust account. Interestingly, until recently, I finally ordered some new checks because my address had changed enough times and whatever. But until very recently, my trust account checkbook had pre-printed checks with a date on them with a line for 19 blank blank. So, fill in the blank, December 31st, 19 was pre-printed, and I just had to write in 99. So it's been so, I use my trust account so rarely that the checks were over 18 years old. They had the word trust account printed on them. Similarly, the other documents have the word trust account printed on them. But my bank statement, interestingly, in Minnesota, does not come addressed to Richard P. Clem Trust Account. My trust account statement in Minnesota comes from the bank addressed to Richard P. Clem, I think it says MNLTAP, which is perfectly adequate in Minnesota, but it would not be perfectly adequate in Wisconsin because it does not have the word trust account on it. So maybe if you do have a Minnesota-Wisconsin practice, maybe at the very least you should make sure that the bank statement has the word trust account printed on it, because that's a very specific and kind of easy-to-follow rule in Wisconsin. But like I say, there are a lot of specific rules, and again, you want to look at your own state version. So again, Wisconsin Rule 1.15, Iowa Chapter 45 of the court rules, and Minnesota, that appendix to the rules. That's put out on an annual basis by the Office of Lawyers' Professional Responsibility. You want to make sure that you're fully complying with all of those record-keeping rules. And if you want more information on that, again, I have another program that goes into great detail talking about the trust account rules in Iowa, but are pretty similar to the Minnesota rules. That's Rule 1.15. Rule 1.16, we're not going to spend a lot of time on, because it says you can quit whenever you feel like it. Now, it doesn't use those exact words, but if you just do not like this client anymore and you want to get rid of this client, you are almost always at liberty to say to your client, I don't want to be your attorney anymore. Go away. Find some other attorney to represent you. In some cases, that's a really good thing to do. I cannot overestimate the importance of the 100% refund. If you just get involved in this client that you just don't want to deal with, sometimes writing them the check for the 100% refund, even though you've earned every penny of the money and they don't deserve it back, then they'll go away. You don't have to worry about them anymore. But you can almost always withdraw from a representation. And there's a list of things here. Like if you don't pay you, if there's no material adverse effect. There might be some rare situations where the rules say that you have to continue. But in general, Rule 1.16 says you can quit pretty much any time you feel like it, unless the exception applies. So we'll talk about the exception in a minute, because the exception sometimes kind of swallows up that rule. You are required, though, to withdraw, and you cannot take a case in the first place. Obviously, if the representation will result in a violation of the rules or some other law. So, for example, if there's a conflict of interest, well, this rule says that you can't take it because that would give rise to a conflict of interest. or if your physical or mental condition is just such that you cannot engage in this representation, or if you get fired. So this rule makes clear that the client has an absolute right to fire you at any time. Even if it's in a breach of contract, if you have an ironclad retainer agreement saying that they're going to keep paying you to represent them forever, they can still fire you. They have the absolute power to fire you. It might be a breach of contract, and they might owe you damages for firing you, but this rule makes clear that you cannot continue representing them after they utter the words, "You're fired," because they have an absolute power to fire you at any time. You can't continue representing them. You might be able to collect the money they owe you, but you can't continue representing them. But you can drop out of a case almost any time you want, because there are 7 circumstances here, including any other good reason, unless the exception applies. And what that exception is if there's a court rule saying that you must give notice or ask court's permission before withdrawing, that rule takes precedence over this rule. So in any kind of a litigation matter, it's not quite as simple a question, because under the rules of civil procedure, you're almost certainly required to give some kind of notice saying that you're withdrawing from the case, and you have to do that even if you're fired or even if you quit. And also, the rules of criminal procedure in Minnesota, anyway, say that you have to get the court's permission before withdrawing from a representation. And the general consensus from criminal defense attorneys that I've talked to in Minnesota is that if you ask for permission to withdraw from the case, the answer to that request will be no. You cannot withdraw from this case. So again, that rule takes precedence over this rule. So even though the rule says, yeah, you can quit representing this client anytime you feel like it, as a practical matter in a criminal case, that is not true. And you will be stuck in that case for the duration. Now, interestingly, other states apparently are a little bit more lenient, because I've asked attorneys in, I think it was Iowa, I asked, how are the courts about getting permission to withdraw from a criminal case? And the general consensus is, they're pretty good about it. But in Minnesota, they're not pretty good about it. In general, the court will say no unless you have some extremely compelling reason. I've been told many times that the client is not paying me is not a compelling reason. So the long and short of that is, in criminal cases, you want to get your money up front, because if the client stops paying you, you're still required to keep representing them. Even though you can quit anytime you feel like it, pretty much, there are 2 restrictions. First of all, you have to take reasonable steps to protect their interests. You can't just leave them totally on the lurch. You can't quit the night before trial without at least going in and asking the court for a continuance or something. So you have to take reasonable steps to protect your client's interests, even though you have the right to withdraw. And you have to give the client's papers back to them. You can't keep their file. And now the rule says that you have to give the client back their file if the client is entitled to getting it back. Well, I'll tell you right now that, yes, the client is entitled to get it back. Because the papers belong to the client. The only reason those words are added in there is if it's some kind of a work product type thing. So the client is entitled to get their papers back. So they retain you to draft the complex trust agreement. They're paying you, thousands of dollars to draft this document. And then you finish drafting the document, they come into your office and say, oh, by the way, you're fired. I want my file back. Well, you have to give them back the file, but you can take out that paper that they haven't paid for yet, because they're not entitled to that paper. And that's really the only reason why that rule is in there, because the client is entitled to get their file back. You can keep a copy of it if you want, probably, but you have to give them back the original, and you cannot, most importantly, you cannot condition return of the file upon payment or anything like that. And so if there are copying costs involved, you want to make a copy of the file. Well, maybe you can send the client a bill for making those copies, but you can't condition return of the file upon payment of those copying costs. because the client, like I say, is entitled to the return of their file. Let's see. And here at this point, I'm going to give our next code number of E369 is the second code number for this portion of the program. You can quit whenever you feel like it, but that court rule about asking court permission might take precedence over that. Rule 1.17 talks about the sale of a law practice. And as I've mentioned in other parts of the program, there's a provision that says you cannot pay or receive referral fees, but you are permitted to buy or sell a law practice as a going business. Rule 1.17 makes clear that that's permissible, even though, in a sense, that's a kind of referral fee, because you're selling your practice to somebody, well, you're referring all of your cases to the new person that you just who just bought it. That's permissible as long as it's a bona fide sale of the business. And the main restriction is you really have to be retiring from the practice of law, either entirely or within a geographic area or within a practice area. So if I decide to retire from the practice of law, you can buy my practice as a going business. Or if I have an office in Minneapolis and another office in Duluth, and I decide to close the Duluth office, well, I can sell the Duluth office to you as a going business. Even though I'm continuing to practice law in Hennepin County, I can sell you my St. Louis County practice. If I'm retiring from a particular practice area, I don't want to do DWIs anymore, so I sell my entire DWI practice to you. I can do that even though I'm continuing to practice in some other area. But it has to be a bona fide sale of the business to operate as an exception to that rule about referral fees. Duties to a prospective client. Up until now, you know, there are conflicts of interest duties and confidentiality duties with respect to your actual clients. Rule 1.18 talks about the situation of somebody walking into your office who wants to hire you. And the definition of a prospective client is somebody who communicates with you in the hopes of forming an attorney-client relationship. And Rule 1.17 says that that communication that they have with you, or Rule 1.18, I'm sorry, says that that communication that they have with you is just as confidential as if they were an actual client. If any time anybody talks to you toward the end of forming an attorney-client relationship, everything that they say is confidential. Everything that you gather out of that meeting. Now, is this rule subject to abuse? Yes, it is, because, and I hear about this happening occasionally, I went out drunk driving last night, and I was careening all over the place, crashing into stuff, this morning I realized that I'm in a lot of trouble, and all kinds of people are going to be suing me. I can't stop them from suing me, but I can keep the best attorney in town from suing me. I'm just horrified that one of those injured plaintiffs will come into your office and want you to represent them against me, because you'll do a very effective job. So I want to make sure that you are off the case. So what I do is, as soon as I sober up, I walk into your office and I say, "Hi, I want to hire you as my attorney." Because last night I caused all kinds of negligent damage all over town, and I caused all these problems, and these people are going to be suing me, and I want you to represent me. I don't have any money to pay you, but I want you to represent me. And then I start blurting out damaging information. And before you can stop me, I've blurted out all kinds of damaging information about myself. I admit to the fact that I was drunk, give away the case. And you obviously don't want me, so eventually you shut me up and you kick me out of the office. But then the next day, those injured plaintiffs start hobbling into your office, And unfortunately, you have to tell them, I'm sorry, I can't take your case because we have a conflict of interest because the defendant was just in here blurting out all this other stuff. So you're totally unjust, but you have to go find yourself another attorney. I'm sorry. And unfortunately, that tactic will work. So you have to be careful to screen people who might, be doing that because apparently there are people like that. There is a small amount of protection. What you can do is if you see me coming, then what you do is you send one person out to deal with me, and you have all of the other attorneys in your office lock themselves in their office and turn the radio up full blast so that they can't hear me. If you do that, if you took reasonable steps to keep me from blurting out the information, then you are still excluded from taking the case, but at least the other attorneys in your office can, in that situation, still take that case against me and bring me to justice. So you'll be off the case, but at least they will be able to make sure that, like I say, that those defendants are properly compensated the next day. So that's Rule 1.18, your duties to a prospective client. After over 2 hours, we have now 2.5 hours practically. We have finally gotten through Rule One because all these so far we've only finished Rule One, and we still have to talk about Rules 2 through 8. Fortunately, Rules 2 through 8 go a lot faster. So because Rule One talks about your duties to your client, which is obviously a pretty big deal about ethics. The other rules talk about some other issues. So we'll actually blast through the rest of the rules a little bit faster, quite a bit faster. Rule 2, I promise you, we'll get through a lot faster because it's pretty short. Rule 2.1 simply says that, yes, when you're giving advice to your client, if you wish, you can give your client more advice than just strictly legal advice. So if you're, if your client comes in and says, I want to foreclose the mortgage on Christmas Eve, you certainly have the legal right to do that, but it might look bad in the newspapers if you do that. Rule 2.1 makes clear that you are permitted to give that non-legal advice, simply because your attorney does not mean you've forgotten everything else you know about other things. There's no requirement to do that, but you're permitted to. Rule 2.2 is easy because we don't have a Rule 2.2 in Minnesota or Iowa or Wisconsin. Well, Wisconsin has a Rule 2.2 that covers a different subject. I think it is the one that talks about guardians ad litem. So if you're a guardian ad litem in Wisconsin, you want to take a look at Rule 2.2. But no Minnesota or Iowa attorney has ever gotten in trouble for violating Rule 2.2 because we don't have one. It was a rule adopted by the American Bar Association that didn't catch on in most states. It deals with conflicts between your clients. It was kind of a too sticky of a situation for most to handle. Rule 2.3 in Minnesota might have a different number in other states, but in Minnesota and Iowa, Rule 2.3 says that, yes, you are permitted to evaluate your client's situation on behalf of third parties. So Rule 2.3 is talking about can you write a formal opinion letter on behalf of your client? And obviously you can. That's something that we do. But it just makes clear that if you are expressing an evaluation on behalf of your client to a third party, make sure that you have very, very informed consent about that, and you don't want to say negative things about your client in either that formal opinion letter or, your client asks you informally to call the landlord and say that the case is about to settle and the rent will get paid. Yes, you are permitted to do that under Rule 2.3, but if you're before providing negative information. So if you're going to write a title opinion on behalf of your client's title and, you discover there's a huge storm cloud, you have to talk to your client about that before writing that opinion. And finally, if you are ever serving as a third-party neutral, such as an arbitrator or mediator, then the rules, then this imposes you don't have any duty to the people there as an attorney-client relationship, but you do have the duty to clear up any misunderstandings if you as a third-party neutral start to suspect that one of the people there believes that you are providing unbiased legal advice to them, you have to clear up that misunderstanding. And that's Rule 2.4, which might have a different rule number in some states. So there, as promised, we got through Rule 2 a lot faster. Now, Rule 3 and 4, we're really going to go through very, very fast because Rule 3 covers a lot of things that that you know better, that you're not going to do any of these things. You're not going to lie to the court. You're not going to falsify evidence. You're not going to, harass third parties and so forth. So, so Rule 3 and Rule 4 are extraordinarily important rules, and you want to look them over. You want to be familiar with them, but you already know these things. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time telling you that you're not supposed to falsify evidence and so forth, because you already know that. And more importantly, even if you were planning on doing that, me telling you not to is not going to do any good. So, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on these because most of them are common sense. But we're going to hit some of the high points on these rules because some of them are maybe not quite so intuitive. You're not supposed to advance unmeritorious claims. So you have to, you can't present a frivolous case to the court. Rule 3, well, that's Rule 3.1. 3.2 says you're supposed to expedite litigation. You're not supposed to delay litigation. You're supposed to expedite things, but consistent with the interest of your client. So if it's in your client's best interest to delay the litigation, well, that is what you're supposed to do. But you're not supposed to delay just for the sake of delay. You're supposed to be candid with the court. You're not supposed to make false statements of fact. You're not supposed to make false statements of law or offer evidence that you know to be false. There's the only time you have an affirmative duty to tell the case for the other side is kind of an ex parte situation or if it's a case that you know is directly on point that's contrary to you. But other than that, you rely on the other side to present the other side's case. But you can't mislead the court. Obviously, you have to be fair to the other other side. And when we look through Rule 3.4, you sound like an ethical person taking this course, and I'm sure you would not do most of these things. You're not going to obstruct somebody's access to evidence. You're not going to do all these things listed in Rule 3.4. One thing that you have to watch out for, because there might be some situations where this is the thing that an ethical attorney would do, and that is number 6. You're not supposed to request somebody other than your client not to voluntarily give information to the other party. In general, you have a duty to make sure that the other side has full access to the witnesses and everything, and you can't try to keep the other side from talking to the witnesses or hide them places and things like that. And that's what this rule says. But on the other hand, there are some situations where maybe that is appropriate. So you, you're on the phone with the witness, who saw the accident. And it's a neutral witness, not connected with either side. And he tells you what happened in the accident and it was all the other guy's fault. And, you happen to know that the attorney in this case on the other side is, there's always one attorney in town who, kind of spoils our reputation for everybody. And you, unfortunately, are up against that that cantankerous, obstinate attorney that nobody likes on the other side. You're talking to the witness, and you tell him that information. You say, that other lawyer on the other side, who nobody likes him. When he gets you on the witness stand, he's going to twist everything that you have to say. He's going to try to put words in your mouth. And I'm just telling you, if you don't want to, you have every right not to talk to that person. Well, maybe that was the right thing for you to say, but when those words come out of your mouth, you have to be aware of this rule because that's exactly what you were doing. You requested somebody other than your client not voluntarily give information to the other side. Now, it might be appropriate, but if you do that, you have to make sure that you're scrupulously following this rule, and you have to believe that that person's interest will not be adversely affected. So you have to be careful when you make statements like that because, there might be exceptions to it, but you're really running up against this rule. Once again, impartiality and decorum of the tribunal. You're not going to disrupt the tribunal or anything like that. And also, many of the people who take this program are not litigators. So they'll look at this and they'll say, this is where the rules about jury contact are. Well, I don't have to worry about that because I'm not a litigator. I don't involve myself in any kind of jury cases. But even if you fit that description, you want to be aware of this rule because this rule talks about juror contact. And if you're a litigator, you know these rules better than I do. You know that you're not supposed to communicate with the juror you're not supposed to communicate with the juror, period. Even the most minor things while the trial is actually going on. But also, you know that. So during the trial, a lawyer connected with the case cannot communicate with the jury. A lawyer who is not connected with the case cannot talk to a member of the jury about the case. That rule could come to haunt even the non-litigator, because what case are they talking about? Well, the case you're not connected with. In other words, every case in the world. So how that could come into play, where you have to watch out, and this happens to lawyers occasionally, is you're a lawyer. Maybe you don't even practice law on a regular basis, but your neighbor knows that you're a lawyer, and your neighbor just got called for jury duty. So your neighbor got on jury duty, and of course they feel like talking about it. They know that you're a lawyer, and they want to talk to you about their experiences as a juror. So they say, "I just got picked for jury duty today." And I say, "Well," so you say to them, "Well, that's good. You know, I hope you do your civic duty well." And so forth. But then they start talking about the case. And they say, "Well, here's what the case is about. And I think the guy is guilty because he looks guilty. And I did this, and I think this, I think that." So he's communicating with you about the case, which is the one thing he's not supposed to do. Your neighbor should know better because the very last thing that the judge told them when they went home that day was, "You're not supposed to talk about the case with anyone." And that's exactly what they're doing. Unfortunately, you are also in trouble because you also know better, and you're violating this rule because you're talking with a member of the jury about the case that you have absolutely no involvement with whatsoever. And so this applies to any juror anywhere in the world. So if your Facebook friend in Australia is talking with you about the jury trial that he's serving on, that's a violation of this rule because you're talking with the juror about the case. So what you have to do is, first of all, absent yourself from that conversation as quickly as possible. And if it's bad enough, you might have an obligation to bring that to the attention of the judge in that case. So you might put yourself in a position where you have to find the judge in Australia to tell him about this juror misconduct that's going on in their case. Because your other obligation is if you become aware of actual juror misconduct, you have a duty to bring that to the court's attention because you are an officer of the court. So if you ever become aware of juror misconduct, even though you have absolutely nothing to do with litigation, this rule is still implicated. And at this point, I'm going to give our next code number for this portion of the program. Our next code number is E377, E377 is the next code word for this portion of the program as we conclude Rule 3.5. Turning to Rule 3.6, trial publicity. If you're involved in litigation, I don't know if there are rules about trial publicity. In any jury case or any criminal case, but any jury case, even a civil case, you are not supposed to make public statements that might potentially prejudice the jury in the case. That's what Rule 3.6 says. Now, it seems to me that there are some First Amendment implications of Rule 3.6. Why do we have a First Amendment? We have a First Amendment to so that we can affect decision makers in important public matters. There's a fine line between prejudicing the jury and getting your client's side out there. So be aware. It seems to me it's perfectly appropriate if your client is being lynched in the media, and all kinds of bad things are being said about your client. It seems to me that you maybe have a right to get that information out there, saying that no, all this information that is being said about my client is not true. I want to set the record straight. Here's what really happened with my client. Even though maybe your main reason in saying that is so that you can communicate with that potential future juror who's out there somewhere. You want to get information in the hands of that future juror for the case that hasn't even been filed yet. Well, I think you have a perfect right to do that. But keep in mind that someone else might interpret Rule 3.6 a little bit differently, because really, what you're doing there is you're trying to prejudice that future jury. Any jury case, even a civil case, Rule 3.6 applies to. So you want to be careful and be aware that when you exercise your First Amendment rights, there are going to be some implications under Rule 3.6. Rule 3.7 says that you as a lawyer are not supposed to be a witness, except maybe for minor things. If you were a prosecutor or a former prosecutor, you want to take a close look at Rule 3.8, because Rule 3.8 says that you have an ethical obligation not to bring charges against somebody for which you do not believe it's supported by probable cause. And as a former prosecutor, you have a duty maybe for the rest of your life if you become aware of miscarriages of justice with which you might have been associated. So you want to take a look at Rule 3.8, which varies a little bit from state to state. Rule 3.9 is, if you are ever a representative in a non-adjudicative proceeding, such as you are testifying before a legislative committee or an administrative agency, Rule 3.9 simply says that you cannot, if you are there in a representative capacity, you have to disclose the fact that you are there in a representative capacity. So if your client wants to go down and testify to the legislature about why this law should be changed, and you're there on behalf of the client, you can't just go down there and try to pass yourself off as a concerned citizen. You don't have to identify the client necessarily, but you have to disclose the fact that you're there in a representative capacity. Rule 4 is more stuff that you as an ethical attorney would never dream of doing, so we'll just hit the high points. You can't make untruthful statements. You can't. You have to be careful in your communications with people represented by counsel. You have to be careful dealing with unrepresented people. Now, the truthfulness in statements to others. Honesty is the best policy, but sometimes as an ethical, zealous attorney, you have to push the envelope of that rule. For example, one case that comes up, and most states have kind of a pretty well-settled jurisprudence on this, what about the use of a tester in a civil case? So you are representing a person who is accused or is believes that they were discriminated against because of their race in housing, for example. They're a black person and they were denied an apartment, and you think it was because of their race. How do you prove that case? Well, you ask the defendant, why did you not rent an apartment to them? Say, well, because we don't rent to people of certain races. Well, that's kind of unlikely to happen. You're more likely that you'll need circumstantial evidence. So how do you get circumstantial evidence? Well, one way to get circumstantial evidence in a pretty solid case is you hire some testers. You hire two actors, one white person and one black person. You send the white person in and say, hello, I want to rent an apartment. And they say, why, yes, let me grab the keys. Let me show you this apartment that we have available. And then, but then a black person comes in and says, hello, I would like to rent an apartment. And they say, I'm sorry, we don't have any apartments. We just have absolutely no vacancies. So good luck to you finding another place. I'm sorry we couldn't help you. Well, that's pretty compelling evidence of discrimination, and you are to be applauded for doing that. You did the right thing. You did the ethical thing. But you have to be careful because maybe you violated Rule 4.1 because those people who were acting on your behalf, they were not being truthful because they walked in and said, hello, I want to rent an apartment. And that was an absolute lie. They were not there to rent an apartment. They did not want to rent an apartment. They were there for one reason, and that was just to gather evidence. So they made an untruthful statement on your behalf. Now, most states who address that will say, yes, that is a perfectly appropriate thing to do. But any time you kind of flirt with untruthfulness like that, you have to be aware that, that Rule 4.1 exists. On the other hand, you can't send your tester in if you know that the person is represented by an attorney, because that is kind of an absolute rule, 4.3. You can't communicate directly with somebody you know to be represented by an attorney. Now, it seems to me if I represented discriminating landlords, I would have them put up a sign in their office and saying, we are represented in all of our discrimination cases, past, present, and future, by the following attorney. And they put that sign up, well, then they're a represented person. And that would kind of keep your testers out. On the other hand, that sign would probably be evidence as well. So that maybe they're better off not putting that up. And I wouldn't represent them anyway. So you have to watch out when dealing with unrepresented persons. You have to respect the rights of third parties. You can't harass them just for the sake of harassing them. If you're suing somebody, they always get harassed, but it has to have a legitimate reason. But you can't engage in abuse the process. Rule 5 talks about the responsibilities of your other people in your office. Rule 5.1 talks about what your responsibility is, the boss. And you as a boss have a duty to have measures in place to make sure that the other employees in your office, both attorneys, Rule 5.1, and non-attorneys, Rule 5.3, abide by the rules. You can't just keep your head in the sand. You have to have some affirmative measures in place to keep your employees under supervision and provide them guidance. Rule 5.2 talks about the duties of the employee. Rule 5.2 says that the I was only following orders defense is not a defense. You are guilty of a violation of the rules even if your boss ordered you to commit that violation. With subject to a minor or small exception, if in a gray area, if you don't know exactly what to do, it's an arguable question, you go to your boss and say, what should I do in this ethical dilemma? And your boss says to do one thing. Well, you're protected as long as that's a reasonable answer. And then in that one very limited case, you can say, I was only following orders. Rule 5.4 says you can't share a fee with a non-attorney. Rule 5.5 says, it's entitled Unauthorized Practice of Law, except the one thing that you are incapable of, the one thing that you can never be accused of is the unauthorized practice of law, because you're a lawyer. You can't engage in the unauthorized practice of law. What this rule spends a lot of time talking about is what are you allowed to do in other states where you are not admitted to practice law. Now, first of all, I should point out that if you are a Minnesota lawyer, you don't need to look at Minnesota Rule 5.5. That has no application to you because you're incapable of committing the unauthorized practice of law in your own state. So the question comes up is if you ever go to another state and do something that's arguably the practice of law there, you have to look at that other state's version of the rule to see what it has to say about what you are allowed to do. So I, as a Minnesota attorney, if I go to Iowa, then I have to look at Iowa Rule 5.5 and see what it has to say. Or if you're a Wisconsin attorney and you come to Minnesota, you have to get out the Minnesota version of Rule 5.5. Fortunately, in all three of those states and most of the other states, the rules say pretty much the same thing. And there's actually quite a lot that you're allowed to do within the confines of another state. You can do things in connection with your practice back home. So, yes, I, as a Minnesota attorney, can go to Wisconsin take a deposition in my Minnesota case, and I don't need some Wisconsin attorney present for the deposition. because that's reasonably related to my practice back home. Or the really big one that allows you to do a lot of stuff in another state is if I can give advice and I can do things in connection with a potential or pending proceeding in some other state, if I reasonably believe I will be given the authority to practice law in that state. So I go to Wisconsin and I look at the Wisconsin court rules, and the Wisconsin court rules say that Minnesota attorneys who ask to practice pro hac vice are routinely admitted in either the state or the federal court. Well, as soon as I know that fact, I can start getting ready for that case that I might file someday in Wisconsin State Court. I can start interviewing the witnesses. I can start giving legal advice to my Wisconsin client. As long as I reasonably believe that this will culminate in something where I will be authorized to practice in that court, even though I don't, even though I'm not admitted to practice in that court yet. So that gives actually gives you allows you to do a lot in other states. But you have to be careful. The rule 5.5 that I talked about here is in effect in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, the Dakotas. You know, most of the states follow this, but not all of them do. One prominent exception is California. I got an email from somebody in California who wanted me to do something, and I was about to get ready to say, yeah, I can help you. I can help you with that. Because if it had been a Wisconsin person, it clearly would have fitted within that exception. But I decided, you know, I better take a look at the California rules on that. And it's a good thing I did, because if I would have taken that case on, I would have been guilty of criminal unauthorized practice of law in California. And I'd be speaking to you from San Quentin today. So you do have to check that other state's version of Rule 5.5. Or equivalent. What you're not allowed to do in some other state is open up an office there or have any kind of a systematic presence or try to pass yourself off as being authorized to practice. You can fly in to visit your clients in that pending case, but you can't set up an office there. Rule 5.6 says that lawyers can't engage in covenants not to compete. So you have to be careful, especially if you're a non-attorney. Make sure that, or if you're not practicing on a regular basis in a general employment contract, you know, saying that, you know, I'm not going to compete within this area. Make sure that that can't arguably cover the practice of law. If you Rule 5.7 covers the situation of non-attorneys, you assisting non-attorneys in. No, I'm sorry. Rule 5.7 talks about law-related services. And a law-related service is something like tax preparation or something that can be done by non-attorneys. It's perfectly legal for them to do it. But it can also logically be done by attorneys. And this answers the question of if I'm engaged in tax preparation, do the rules of professional conduct apply to me? Because after all, the guy down at H&R Block doing that, he doesn't have to worry about getting disbarred for what he does doing tax preparation because he's not an attorney. Well, generally, if it's not distinct from the practice of law, then I do have to worry about all these rules in that. But if it's totally unrelated to my practice of law, then it doesn't do it. Rule 6 covers all the various pro bono rules. We as attorneys are encouraged and even required to engage in certain pro bono activities. Specifically, we shall aspire, doesn't say we actually have to do it, but you shall aspire to do 50 hours of pro bono work to satisfy the legal needs of people of limited economic means. You shall aspire to at least 50 hours of such service. In addition, you should do other public service-related activities. You should try to improve the law. You should try to help the environment. You should try to do all kinds of stuff. But your 50-hour obligation is assisting persons of limited economic means, people who are not able to pay for an attorney to help them with those needs. Because we are encouraged to do pro bono activities, the remainder of Rule 6 says that now, there may be some exceptions to the conflict of interest rules in certain pro bono situations. And before I say that, Rule 6.2 says you shall not try to avoid being appointed counsel by a court. But with those pro bono issues in mind, there's certain exceptions to the conflict of interest rule. So, for example, if you're on the board of directors of a legal services organization, a nonprofit, the clients of that nonprofit might have conflicts of interest with your clients in your regular law firm. That conflict of interest might be overlooked in that situation, but you might have to recuse yourself from those particular situations. Law reform clients activities. You're campaigning for improvement of some section of the Minnesota statutes or something. Rule 6.4 says that's a laudable thing for you to do, even if maybe that might harm your current clients if it's a law reform activity. Rule 6.5 says that if you are taking part in a law clinic, kind of nonprofit, people can come in and talk to a lawyer because the volunteers from the Bar Association are there. If you don't have to be quite so obsessive about screening for conflicts of interest. If you're aware of an actual conflict of interest, then you can't give advice to those people. But if you inadvertently give advice contrary to the interest of your paying clients, it's excused a little bit because you're engaging in that public service activity. Rule 7 talks about communication with the public. It talks about advertising. Rule 7.1 says that in no public statement that you make should you be false or misleading. Rule 7.2 is where it says that you can't pay referral fees. But one exception to the referral fees is an advertisement, because you put an ad in the newspaper, well, you're paying the newspaper to refer people to you. But as long as it's a bona fide advertisement placed at the normal advertising rates, that's okay. And here I'm going to give one more code number, E391. E391 is our next code number. E391. Advertising is okay, and there are really very few substantive restrictions on advertising, other than you have to disclose who you are. Every advertisement for a lawyer has to give the name of the attorney or law firm who is responsible for it. So you can't advertise anonymously. If you put up a big billboard saying, call 1-800-INJURY. You can't just have that billboard there. You have to have your name or the name of your firm there. Unless you change the name of your firm to, 1-800-INJURY-LLC or whatever. But the name of the firm responsible for the ad has to be there. Rule 7.3 talks about, can you send letters to people you think are in need of legal services, like all the people who got arrested over the weekend? Yeah, you can. But you have to scrupulously comply with these rules, so you read them carefully if you ever dream of doing that, because there are some very specific requirements, like what has to be printed on the outside of the envelope. In Wisconsin, I believe you have to send a copy to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Minnesota and Iowa do not have that requirement. So if you do it in Wisconsin, you want to. You have to find the right affidavit form, and you have to send it to some office in Madison. You can say that you limit your practice to a certain area, or that you practice only in this area. Be really careful if you ever use any word like specialist or specialized or certified. In fact, just don't use those words, because if you use those words, then you have to show that some special requirements apply. So, for example, if you are a certified real property specialist by the Minnesota Bar Association, you can say that. But the certifying agency has to be approved by the Minnesota Supreme Court. And other states have very, very similar requirements as to what certifying agencies. So, in other words, I cannot, for $99.95, send you a certificate suitable for framing saying that you are a certified whatever you want me to fill in the blank with, as certified by the CLEM Board of Legal Certification. I could do that, but it wouldn't do you a lot of good because you would not be able to advertise that because the CLEM Board of Legal Certification is not approved by the Minnesota Supreme Court to do that. So I can't do that. Don't use the word certified or specialist or anything, because one hapless attorney, I think in New York, got himself into a little bit of trouble by saying he specialized in tough cases. Well, he was not certified by the National Association of Tough Cases, so he got in trouble. Your firm name, yeah, you can use a trade name for your firm. The rules vary a little bit. Be really careful if you use the name of a geographic place. So my office is located in Ramsey County, Minnesota. So I call my law firm the Ramsey County Attorneys. Well, I'd probably get in a little bit of trouble if I did that because there's a government agency by that same name. It looks deceptively similar to that. So really, anytime you use the name of a city or a county or a state, you run the great risk of doing that. So don't use those. Call yourself, Gopher State Bankruptcy Attorneys, not Minnesota Bankruptcy Attorneys, because if you use the word Minnesota or Iowa or Dane County or Des Moines, you run the risk of being mistaken for a government agency, which you don't want to do. Don't make political contributions to a judge in order to obtain an appointment. Okay, in our last few minutes here, we'll blast through Rule 8, which covers some of the miscellaneous stuff. Before I start that, I'm going to give one last code number, E301, E301, E301 is our very last code word as we wrap up the last 5 or so minutes of the program. Because Rule 8 covers all the miscellaneous stuff. If you are in bar admissions and disciplinary matters, you have a duty to be truthful with the state bar authorities in your own case and in other people's cases. You might have an obligation, if you become aware of misconduct, you have an obligation to turn your friends in. If you are aware that another attorney has violated the rules, you have a duty to disclose it, unless it's confidential, because of a attorney-client confidentiality or because of an authorized lawyer assistance program. If you're a drug counselor for the state lawyer assistance program, then you're not required to disclose that either because that's confidential. Similarly, you have a duty to point out any judicial misconduct that you might become aware of. If you ever run for judge, you have a duty to comply with the Code of Judicial Conduct. Again, it's Rule 8.3 that says that you have an obligation to report any misconduct by another attorney or judge. 8.4 is miscellaneous. Different states have different miscellaneous rules, things that they forgot to put in the other rules. They included in Rule 8.4 because these are the miscellaneous provisions, stuff they forgot to think of. And so any dishonest or criminal act or that reflects on your trustworthiness or fitness. And then different states have different things. Most states have something saying that if you violate discrimination laws, if you harass somebody, on behalf of even if maybe it's unrelated to the practice of law, that's a violation of the rules of professional conduct. The wording of state versions of that might vary a little bit. Check your miscellaneous rules. Some states, for example, say it's a violation of the rules to not pay court ordered child support. So you want to check that out. Finally, Rule 8.5 talks about some kind of multi-state things. These days many things affect more than one state, you might be admitted to practice in more than one state. Which state's rules apply? Well, usually you don't have to worry about it too much because, as we've seen, Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, the rules are pretty much the same. So it doesn't really matter which state's rules you apply. But you are subject to discipline not only in the state where you are admitted, but in any state where you are practicing law, either, you know, legitimately, you know, because it's in connection with that, you know, I'm taking the Wisconsin deposition in my Minnesota case. I'm subject to discipline in Wisconsin in addition to Minnesota. But what state's law applies? Well, for me, it's easy because I'm admitted only in one state. Therefore, Minnesota law applies to me. If you are admitted in more than one state, generally you go by what the state where you have your principal place of business. So if I have my office, if I'm admitted in Wisconsin, but I have my office in Minnesota, generally Minnesota rules apply to me, unless what I'm doing has its predominant impact in another state. So if I am taking a deposition in Wisconsin, perhaps the Wisconsin rules apply to me if it has its predominant effect in that state. Or certainly if I'm appearing in court in Wisconsin, then the rules of the state that tribunal apply. Well, anyway, after about 3 hours and almost 3.5 hours here, we have made our way through the Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin rules of professional conduct. So once again, after you've listened to the program, please email those code numbers to me on the page where you signed up for the program. It has all the instructions, but you can just email them to clem.law, clem.law@usa.net, and I will get you your certificate of attendance. If you do have questions about the program, please email those to me, and I will get back to you within probably the same day, but certainly within the time permitted by your state's rules if you do have any substantive questions about any of the rules we've covered. So thank you once again for joining me. If you're interested in checking out other courses, be sure to look them up at richardclem.com, where you will find more information about all my upcoming programs. So thank you once again, and I look forward to seeing you at future programs.